Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us.
Jean and I are staying in Norton, and we got driven to the city limits of Norton.
At an October gathering under a new solar pavilion in Whitesburg, Apple Shop celebrated its 50th anniversary. Over those five decades, Apple Shop staff have used media, arts, and education to document the life, celebrate the culture, and voice the concerns of people living in Appalachia and rural America. Filmmaker Herbie Smith was there when it all began. He joins us from Apple Shop's radio station WMMT, along with Willa Johnson, director of the Appalachian Media Institute. Thank you for joining us on Eastern Standard.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So, Herbie, Bill and Josephine Richardson are credited with actually starting Apple Shop, I think back in 1969. And you were there in those early days when people were still thinking about imagining what Apple Shop might become someday and what it might accomplish. Can you take us back to those times and tell us what the early vision was?
Well, there was this idea that we could use this newly invented portable production equipment to make films about this part of the country. And I think there were two big ideas from the organization that fostered the development of Apple Shop. It was a group called Community Film Workshop Council. They were based in New York City, and they were setting up community film workshops. I think there were 10 of them throughout the country. And as far as my role, I was happened to be in this small town, Whitesburg, Kentucky, when this film workshop arrived. So I had nothing to do with, the decision to locate it there. It's just blind luck, I guess you could say.
And had you been fooling around with a camera at that point, or is this what inspired you to get into filmmaking?
Oh, it was completely availability of technology. You know how kids are, and I have a five-year-old granddaughter, and she's can do more with my iPhone than I can. And it's amazing how that they're just, when you're young, you're excited about experimenting with the gear, really.
Mm-hmm. I've watched a film that you made when you were 17, In Your Blood, it's called. And it portrays the tension that Appalachian youth experience between staying home in the mountains versus going off to college and perhaps never coming back. Does that tension persist to this day?
Yes, it does, of course. And I think it persists in small towns throughout the world. You know, the lure of going away and finding a place in a distant city versus remaining in this case, a very small town in a coal mining area. And, of course, in those years, particularly in the 50s and 60s, there was a lot of outmigration that had to do with new mining technologies that were displacing thousands and thousands of workers. So, I mean, there were 300 of us in Whitesburg High School as freshmen. About 180 of us graduated. And I would say by the end of the summer of 1970, maybe 50 and still in Eastern Kentucky. It was just get your ticket punched and go. It was generally what was happening to a lot of the young people trying to figure out how to find meaningful work.
And Willa Johnson, let me bring you into that question. What have been your observations about that?
I grew up here in this region as well and went through the program that I now direct. And every summer we show In Your Blood because it still resonates with young people today. Young people are often taught that success means leaving. I don't think that we have the same, maybe not the same numbers of out-migration that Herbie's generation was experiencing, but it still is very much this idea that if you want to find success, if you want to find a future, then you have to go. But that leaves a lot of people who really love their home and love where they're at torn between whether or not they can find happiness and success here. And so we show the film every summer, and every summer I watch young people connect to it because it still captures what they're learning and what they're experiencing in their lives today.
We've heard from a number of people who are working diligently to try to reverse that trend, that out-migration trend, by doing some very interesting things in Appalachian communities. The most recent that comes to mind was I talked with Robert Geip about his work in Harlan County, and that was his stated goal. Are you seeing that throughout the region as well?
Yes, and there's actually a very functional network of mutual aid and support that's been going on. For example, Robert worked at Apple Shop for a number of years, mm-hmm. and we've always admired what he's going on to do as he's, this acclaimed novelist and also a cultural worker in the fullest extent of the word.
So, Willa, you direct the Appalachian Media Institute, which is right across the street from Apple Shop there in Whitesburg. Tell us what goes on there.
We are essentially the energy that created Apple Shop. We take that idea of training young people to do storytelling and to use media to express themselves, and the idea that we retrain young people every year. And so our main programming happens in the summer. We run the Summer Documentary Institute, where we hire young people ages 14 to 22 to come in and spend 8 weeks really getting storytelling training, learning about media, observing a lot of documentaries, and then also creating mentorships for them from people in the community and artists here at Apple Shop. And then the last 4 weeks, we give them the equipment that they need and ask them to capture a documentary. They'll separate into three groups. So they capture three films to really show us like what it looks like to be a young person living in Appalachia today. And so every year we end up with three short films that sort of are a snapshot in time for what it looks like to be young in Appalachia. And we also do a lot of spring and fall labs as well. So we try to bring in as many opportunities and diverse opportunities as possible. So we also run a 3D printing lab where we've just paid 6 young people to learn how to design and 3D print. And we just started our first animation lab where 5 of our advanced interns who are studying at Morehead State will work with us to create an animation series that'll be aired on a national platform.
Wow. And this is all coming out of Whitesburg.
Yes.
I understand that AMI has attracted the attention of national media, that you often have the CNNs of the world, for example, knocking on your door for some help with things they need. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I think we've created a network of young people who are skilled storytellers and video makers, and we've captured a lot of attention that we're a resource here in the region. So when folks need B-roll or they need video to help tell their story, like ABC News or like CNN, they can contact us and we pull from a resource of young people who have that skill who can go capture that media for them. And it's been a great opportunity for our young people who are figuring out where in media they want to work and where fits best for them to gain that experience and to gain that knowledge of how national media works.
So the young people that are coming to you today to get into film and into media are arriving at that same point in their lives as Herbie was back in the day in 1969. Among them, are you finding that there is still this real driving interest in learning about media arts, about storytelling, about advancing the narrative about the Appalachian region?
I think it's a little of both. I think, sometimes the kids that come to us are the kids who have just been looking for an artistic outlet, who haven't found a place that fits them in public school settings. Often, art and storytelling is underfunded in schools. And so it's young people who are looking for an outlet. And then sometimes it is kids who just know from the beginning that media is where they want to be and that communications is what is their main focus will be in their careers. And so it's a little bit of both. And I think that's the beauty of our programming is that it gives skills. Good storytelling, good media literacy is important for everyone, and especially young people who are having to combat often national stereotypes. to be able to gain that skill and that critique of media narratives is really important in how they view themselves and how they want others to see their home community as well.
Great networking too as well, huh?
We have a strong network of alum who have really been supportive of each other and give opportunities to each other and come back and mentor the next wave of youth every summer. So it's been a really, they often say you can't spell family without AMI. And they really have just become a really strong network for each other.
Well, a question for both of you. I know that there are more than 100 films in the Apple Shop catalog, and I wondered if you could, and this is a tall order, I know, but if you could highlight what we might find if we were to dig into that catalog.
Well, of course, there are new productions in the works at all times and have been for the last 50 years. So it's hard to describe all of the work that's being done, but I think in general, you could say Apple Shop is documenting the history and culture of a given region. And we sometimes make films about things we like about the place, some of the storytelling or musicians or creative work that various incredible artists are doing in the region. For example, the work that Robert Gapp is doing. It's really amazing if you turn over a few rocks, what you find. This is a place that is sometimes being described as a poor place, but it's actually rich in culture and in creative expression. So there's the things that we like, and then there's also we make films about things we don't like. Mm-hmm. For example, we make films about black lung disease, or films about mining accidents, or films about polluted water, and so forth. So there are issue films, I guess you could say, or things that address deep-seated problems that people face here. And then there are also films about the strengths of the region.
Yeah, and the Appalachian Media Institute catalog is, I think, a really rich catalog of seeing Appalachia through a new lens every year. Having roughly an 18-year-old tell you what Appalachia looks like for the last 31 years has been a really unique catalog in that they made one of the first pieces in the nation to address the OxyContin epidemic. We have a huge, rich catalog of films documenting the LGBTQ plus experience. You know, one of the early films they made around LGBTQ plus was around conversion therapy. And then 20 years later, they captured the first same-sex marriage in Letcher County. So it's a really rich catalog of the evolution of Appalachia and showing what it looks like for young people throughout three decades.
Wow.
Our catalog for the Appalachian Media Institute films are available on Vimeo under an Appalachian Media Institute channel.
Okay. I'm thinking back to 1969, Herbie, and the thought of looking forward at that point to the year 2020 and trying to imagine where Apple Shop would be at that point. Here we are, 50 years into it, and I'd like to ask you to think about the year 2070. Where do you think Apple Shop might be 50 years from today?
Well, I think the forces at work are still very much alive and functioning. And the constantly emerging new, brilliant young people is, it's amazing. And every year you're like, whoa, where did that come from? Mm-hmm. So it's, I think all places, I sometimes use this term analysis and creativity, that analysis and creativity can solve about any problem you face. And in fact, that's how we solve problems. And so we find that is alive and kicking right here in some of the most hard-pressed places in the eastern third of Kentucky.
And how about you, Willow? What's in your crystal ball?
What I hope is that even though the medium might change or the style or the equipment might change, that we hold on to our style of storytelling that I think is really unique and special to our region and to our organization. And that is often the best conversations at Appalachia happen around a dinner table or on the front porch. And I think our storytelling reflects that in an age where everything's shortened and everything's quick and everything is like a headline, that we really hold on and maintain that front porch feeling of conversation, and that you can get to real hard issues while still sitting there together. And so I hope that that's where our future goes, is that we maintain that front porch style no matter what the technology is.
Apple Shop filmmaker Herbie Smith and Willa Johnson, director of the Appalachian Media Institute at Apple Shop, really enjoyed visiting with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Coming up after the break,
so many women's stories have been left behind.
Rachel Grimes, author and composer of the folk opera The Way Forth, here with filmmaker Catherine Axley. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Rachel Grimes and Catherine Axley are here with us. You may know Rachel as keyboardist for the Louisville chamber post-rock band Rachels. She's creator of a fascinating multimedia folk opera, The Way Forth, a work that highlights the perspectives of Kentucky women from 1775 to present. It premiered this year with the Louisville Orchestra and was performed at the Big Ears Festival in Knoxville. An album was released on November 1st. And the story has been taken to the screen by Catherine, a Stanford and Yale-educated documentary filmmaker whose films have been screened at the San Francisco International Film Festival, DOC NYC, the Harlem International Film Festival, and the United Nations Association Film Festival. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so
Thanks
much.
Thanks for having us.
And so first, to give our listeners a sense of what we're about to talk about, let's listen to a sampling of music from The Way Forth. Beautiful. It's gorgeous, Rachel.
Thank you, Tom.
Tell us about the discovery that you made and how that inspired you to create this multimedia project.
Well, I made many discoveries, but some were really earth-shattering to me. Most of these discoveries came through photographs or documents and things that were in my family. And my father had especially a lot of boxes and things from multiple generations. And in one of the older photo albums was this envelope, brown envelope that said Old Deeds, an 1849 letter. I was very intrigued, so I opened it. And inside were multiple deeds. There were wills, there were letters, all with, you know, sepia ink and old style of writing. And I just was immediately pulled into it. And amidst all of those documents was a bill of sale, a single page from 1824 here in Madison County for the sale of a woman named Susan and her three children. The purchaser was my ancestor. And, just reading through a document like that is time stands still. It's so horrible to read, in person, a document like this. And there were some details that were just especially touching and troubling. And of course, immediately I wondered, who is Susan? And are these her only children? And perhaps Did she have other children that were sold away or that were not able to come with her for some reason? And it was in looking into, you know, just it was just in my imagination. I had no other proof of her life. Of course, there was no last name. But just in wondering what her life was like, it set my imagination, you know, into wow. action. And so many of these stories and songs are based on an emotional and or imaginative journey into the lives of these women from the past.
Well, you describe the way forth as an experiential, nonlinear journey. Tell us about that. How experiential? Why nonlinear?
What I'm hoping is that through the narration and the music, the listener can actually feel that they are in the experience with that other person. So they're back in time. They're actually imagining what it would be like to bring your children out into the field while you're working the crops and you're having to tend to the kids too. These little things that you know you can do through your imagination and through listening to the words. Nonlinear because the piece does start, the opening song, Got a Hold of Me, does start from a contemporary standpoint, you know, a modern woman describing her emotions of learning of all these stories, and it's a complex feelings. But immediately, the story rockets into the past, into 1888, and it swerves back and forth through time. So it's not as though we start in 1775 and work our way up. It's more that there are points within the piece that are contemporary reflections, and then something, a musical moment or some words or lyrics bring us into this past or into a single character's experience.
It had been performed as an opera prior to it becoming a film, correct?
Well, it was performed as a concert work with the Louisville Orchestra. That was its premiere.
I see.
It's not a staged opera, but I chose to call it a folk opera because it does have so many characters. There's a singing chorus, and there's a lot of drama to it, and so many words. There's a narrator, and so I felt that, you know, opera was the best description of that experience musically.
Well, Catherine, actually, this is one of those times when I wish we had a visual component here. If we did, we'd call this TV. But anyway, tell us about your initial encounter and experience with the story and the music and how, as a documentarian, as a filmmaker, you envisioned its interpretation as a film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it was for me as a filmmaker to encounter Rachel and to encounter this project was really unusual because I normally think of music in film as, you know, composing music for a finished film. But in this case, we were actually composing film for an almost completed musical work. So that framing of how to approach the film was completely different from anything I had done before. One of the first ways we started filming this project was traveling around Kentucky and stopping in places and spaces that spoke to Rachel in some way. So for me, you know, not being from Kentucky originally and from encountering these locations for the first time, it was important to try to find what about this place or space or abandoned house or riverbed was speaking to Rachel, and how could we find the visuals to evoke the emotions that these places resonated in the music that was already finished. Another visual approach we took was filming kind of abstract vignettes of hands and shoulders and trying to capture everyday activities that women have done for generations as a way to place the viewer in the piece in a visceral way for them to kind of be present in the past in the music. And then finally, we have been working on interludes. One other really kind of interesting and unusual aspects of this filming process has been this constant sense of discovery. And so recently, we have been creating short documentary-style interludes where we're filming conversations that Rachel and others have been having around the research that has been emerging during this project. So we're hoping that these interludes kind of frame the rest of the piece so that viewers are able to kind of be along for this journey of discovery that we've been experiencing.
You mentioned journey and that you did a lot of traveling. Somebody's car has a lot of mileage on it, from what I understand. One of you want to tell me about that, about your travels around Kentucky?
I have a 2005 Tacoma truck that we actually call the manager. And so a very appropriate name. The manager has taken us to all kinds of places, and we just load the gear in the back. And that way we've got four-wheel drive if we need it. And we've needed it a couple times, you know, some gravel roads or some really, you know, deep ruts and river creek beds. But what really came to me in the beginning was that, you know, I've lived in Kentucky my whole life. Both my parents are from Lincoln County. And so I've been driving Kentucky roads my whole life to go visit family, you know, wherever we're going that day or time. And I now live in sort of northwest Kentucky. So for me to come back to my parents' hometown, I come through this mountainous area along the Kentucky River, and I take this same very scenic route every time. And there were so many things along the route that I just became really focused on, and especially the river. The Kentucky River is so beautiful, and the twists and turns and these different views you get of the river from, you know, either being right next to it or being up on a hilltop, that I knew was something that I wanted to have as a theme throughout, because I really feel like the river is our eternal witness. It's our cleansing force in life. Water is so essential, and it's always been here and always will be.
Well, in your email to me, you mentioned that, as you put it, the project explores the eternal grace and redemption of time as symbolized by the great Dixon Kentucky rivers.
Yes, because we filmed a lot on the Dix and the Kentucky rivers, a little bit on the Ohio. And of course, they're all related. The Dix is a smaller river in Lincoln County, and then it feeds into the Kentucky, which feeds into the Ohio River. The Dix River is this stretch that we went to film is next to a farm that has been in my family since, I guess, the land grants. It's not in the family anymore, but the current folks there have invited us to come, and we've been many times because it's a very beautiful natural place. And standing along the banks of the Dix River there, you really can't see any sign of human life. It looks like what I imagine the prehistoric days would look like, and it smells that way. It's so beautiful. There are mussel shells there the size of my hand, my fist. It's a very beautiful natural spot, and it feels holy to me in a way. And I feel like the rivers, you know, are this sort of backdrop of the piece. So we refer to it a lot in the imagery. It's in some of the lyrics. And the river is really almost a character, like a deity, if you will.
In that email, you also mentioned to me that The Way Forth honors the beauty in quotidian life. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, you know, as Catherine mentioned, one of the things that we knew we wanted to try to explore is this idea of these repetitive sort of everyday tasks that women have done and are still doing through time, and men do them too, you know, but we were focusing more on women because we have several women characters in the songs. So we were wanting to look at things like, you know, dressing and preparing, you know, folding a sheet, doing just sort of everyday activities from this sort of vantage point of the person doing them. So rather than, you know, a traditional way of showing in a film is to show a face, I really wanted to avoid that because I wanted the listener to imagine the face, or I wanted the photographs that we were using. We use a lot of archival photos in some of these documents and letters throughout. So I wanted that to be more, you know, when you see a face, it's usually in the photograph. But when you see moving film, you see the landscapes, you see these hands, you see these gestures or these sort of everyday things that are happening. It's, you know, it's nothing profound. It's just normal activities. And it also kind of helps it be unclear, is this now or is this in the past? Hmm. So it has a little bit of a imaginative play there.
I know that one of your stops was Boonesboro.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I'd always heard these stories about relatives that helped settle Fort Boonesboro, and it was one of the subjects that came up in researching some of the family genealogy, and I really needed to answer some questions about who was there and exactly how am I related to them. And that's a much longer story than we have for today. But I got very interested in the fact that so many of the people in our pioneer days and the stories of settlement, you know, were left out of the history, the written history and the stories. And I feel like that is changing, but slowly. And I found a book called Women of Boonesboro by regional writers Anne Crabb and Harry Enoch, which explores the lives, you know, the little shreds of facts we have on the women that were there in the early days of the fort. And one of them was a relative, and then I learned in the same paragraph about that relative of a woman who was actually on that Boone expedition in 1775. Her name is Dolly, and she was enslaved to Richard Calloway. So that blew my mind because I didn't ever know that there were women on that Boone expedition. There were actually two, Daniel Boone's daughter, Rebecca, and this woman, Dolly. And I feel like, you know, this was a prime example of how so many women's stories have been left behind. You know, they weren't written about to begin with. You know, they weren't critical to the story of the person writing the history or to the people in power. So they were left out of the narrative. So we've been to Boonesboro a couple times to shoot the monuments that are there. We went for Descendants Day this year, and we met so many interesting people. We've actually, it has led to a lot of additional steps in filming the interludes that Catherine referred to, too.
When I listen to your music, this album, The Way Forth, and Doctor from India, what I take away from it is that it's a very contemplative music, evocative, thoughtful music.
Thank you.
Is it intentional?
Yes, very much so.
You know, music is always subject to the interpretation of whoever's listening to it, to bring their own baggage to it and see and imagine whatever it is they see. But what one thing do you hope is a universal experience for everyone who encounters your work?
Well, I always hope that each person will have their own experience and that what the music will do for them is help give them a good space in which to listen. And in listening, you know, that will bring up all kinds of memories or thoughts of their own. So everyone will have their own unique experience, but that the music will be a welcoming environment for that contemplation.
And how about you, Catherine? When the person's sitting and watching this film, what do you hope they walk out of the theater thinking?
Well, I think one thing that has really stood out to me with this project is the idea that contradictions are inherent to life. I mean, I feel like Rachel's music is absolutely gorgeous, but there are themes that are dark and that sometimes we don't want to encounter.
So The Way Forth has been performed with the Louisville Orchestra, as I mentioned, at Big Ears Festival in Knoxville. Where else?
We went, I must say that the piece is really not written for full orchestra originally. It's a chamber group for harp and strings, piano, percussion, banjo and guitar, and narrators and singers, which is still a lot of people. But we did it as a full orchestra piece. I orchestrated it for the orchestra because it was a really special invitation. But we took the chamber version to the Knoxville Festival Big Ears, which is wonderful, in March. And then we just got back from the Witching Hour Festival in Iowa City, Iowa, which was just marvelous. And we just had a wonderful time. Usually we're performing in sort of mid-sized historic theaters, which is really what I want to keep doing. Mm. It's a wonderful environment to be in a great acoustic theater with a big screen.
So after talking about this, I'm sure a listener is going to want to know where they can go hear it, see it online. What can they do?
Well, the album is out as of November 1st. There's double vinyl and CD and digital, of course. You can hear it anywhere, you know, Spotify. You can order the record, you know, at your local store or my website, rachelgrimespiano.com. There's lots of ways you can get this music in different file types. The film, we have several chapters of the film available on my YouTube channel, so you can watch those individual songs with the film. The feature-length film with the interludes, little documentary interludes that we talked about, it'll be out sometime next year. So that'll be the final chapter of this ongoing journey.
Rachel Grimes, creator of the folk opera, album, and film The Way Forth, filmmaker Catherine Axley, who carried Rachel's story to the screen. Thank you both for visiting us on Eastern Standard.
Thanks so much for having us.
There is some more. God,
Coming up in just a moment.
There's this kind of cultural sense of what it means to be American is tied to consuming things. And so Christmas gets very much tied into that concept as well.
Black Hills State University history professor Thomas Wyatt on his research exploring how the modern American Christmas became an artifact of the Cold War. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It could be used in a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or other past episodes? You can find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
We have a couple of updates on stories we've been following here on Eastern Standard. A coal company that purchased some mines from bankrupt Black Jewel in eastern Kentucky is now temporarily shutting them down and has laid off workers. Brittany Patterson has more.
Tennessee-based Copperglow Mining purchased Black Jewel's Lone and Black Mountain mining complexes in Letcher and Harlan counties in August. The company agreed to help pay back wages owed to former Black Jewel miners and rehired many to restart production. According to reporting by the Lexington Herald Leader, Copperglow idled its Kentucky mines and laid off more than 100 workers. State Representative Angie Hatton told the newspaper several employees report the mines would remain closed until at least December 26th. Copperglow did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Dozens of miners spent nearly 2 months blocking a coal train in Harlan County after Black Jewel filed for bankruptcy in July. More than 1,000 employees went months without receiving pay. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Brittany Patterson.
In another update, the destruction of chemical weapons at a site near Richmond. Come January, workers at the Bluegrass Chemical Agent Destruction Pilot Plant are expected to begin neutralizing nerve agent. Two citizen advisory groups got an update on preparation at the Bluegrass Army Depot facility, and WEKU's Stu Johnson has the report.
A neutralization process will be used in the demilitarization factory at the Bluegrass Army Depot for GB nerve agent. Destruction of mustard agent began last June, and so far, 13 tons have been destroyed through a detonation chamber process. Plant site project manager Candace Coyle says it's a whole different approach with neutralization.
Day one won't be, I've destroyed ammunition. It might be, I've moved it successfully from this area of the plant to the next. The next stage might be getting to the point where we then punch and drain it. The next step is then we load it onto the metal parts treater, and then, you know, we continue the process from there.
Coyle says by the end of January, some nerve agent munitions should be fully destroyed. The complete disposal of all mustard and nerve agent munitions is scheduled to be completed by the end of 2023. I'm Stu Johnson in Lexington.
Thomas Wyatt is researching and exploring how the modern American Christmas is an artifact of the Cold War. And part of his work looks at the impact of this in Appalachian communities. He presented a paper on his findings at the recent Ohio Valley History Conference, and it was called to our attention by the folks at the Kentucky Historical Society. Given the season, we thought it would be interesting to hear what he has learned so far. Dr. Wyatt joins us from Spearfish, South Dakota, where he is an assistant professor of history at Black Hills State University. Greetings, Dr. Wyatt.
Hello.
So tell us more about the premise of this work. How is the modern American Christmas an artifact of the Cold War standoff between the U.S. and the former USSR?
Well, so when I first started thinking about this project, I was thinking about how Christmas is celebrated in 21st century America, and thinking about kind of connecting back to where do we get some of these ideas from. Now, the idea of kind of a commercialized Christmas is not a new concept, right? Charles Dickens wrote about it in 1843, but this notion of the tension between secular and sacred, which is really kind of part of the modern Christmas interpretation, we see this in the Cold War because there's a promotion of commercial ideas, while at the same time a promotion of kind of quasi-religious ideas, all within this context of the conflict with the Soviet Union in terms of presenting and promoting what it means to be American. And that is tied very much to ideas about democratic capitalism. And so through government actions and the actions of private entities, we see the promotion of this notion of consumerism and consumption as part of the Christmas holiday. So that's where I start from.
Okay. And so our understanding of this holiday, the religious aspect of it aside, you're saying kind of evolves out of America's propaganda war with the Soviet Union.
It does on some levels in terms of trying to promote this idea of what is the good life, what is the American dream, right? In the 1950s and the early 1960s, there is this strong emphasis on this notion of suburban white America living in, you know, Cape Cod ranch houses as far as the eye can see, buying things and making kind of a material world of comfort. And that's promoted both by government action, but also by private entities, and especially through the projected images of television. And so there's this kind of cultural sense of what it means to be American is tied to consuming things. And so Christmas gets very much tied into that concept as well.
When you looked at what was going on in media and primarily television back in those days, back in the 60s, let's say, what did you find? How did you connect the dots there?
Well, one of the things that I think television is a great way of thinking about how ideals are promoted and projected across time and space. So the prescriptive kind of 1950s sitcoms and things like that. But what really caught my attention were the 60s television Christmas specials, the ones that we all kind of, basically every December, it seems everyone kind of trots these out and watches them, right? The Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and Charlie Brown Christmas and Santa Claus is Coming to Town, all of those. And what struck me at one point, when I was working on my doctorate, I watched Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. So it was Christmas time, so I'll watch this. And when my brain shut off and I started watching it, and all these thoughts just started coming into my head about kind of what is actually happening in this special. And it was created in 1964, and it's talking about notions of acceptance and nonconformity and you know, kind of seeing it as an allegory for racial integration in the 1960s, and a lot of different things all happening at once. And I was sitting there, I was talking about all these ideas until someone threw a pillow at me and told me to be quiet because I was ruining their Christmas. And it's true. I mean, you start doing this and you lose track of, oops, maybe I've ruined someone's childhood. But the more I kind of watch these shows, different ideas started popping out at kind of different points between Rudolph and Charlie Brown Christmas. I mean, that one's much more about kind of the secular sacred divide. And Santa Claus is Coming to Town with the Burgermeister, Meister Burger, who kind of looks kind of Nixonian and kind of Santa Claus as maybe a hippie. So it's just such an interesting set of ideas and kind of promoting or projecting cultural values of this period from 1964 to 1970 through these specials that we largely forget as we watch them in a more nostalgic way, but they really are artifacts of that moment when they were created.
And is that coincidental to the tensions that were going on between the U.S. and the Soviet Union at the time, or was there intentionality involved?
Well, and so here's where it gets into a really kind of a interesting and difficult thing for historians in terms of intentionality. It's hard to know what the intention is in some cases versus what the reception is. Someone watching it, regardless if it is the intention of the directors or not, or the producers, can receive a message in a slightly different way. Now, as far as the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, Rankin Bass, the people who created this, talked about it as Rudolph overcoming a handicap, that somehow his difference made him handicapped, and that he found a way to overcome that and become part of society. So someone watching it and getting a sense of this notion of kind of integration might not have looked at it as Rudolph overcoming a handicap, but overcoming some sort of impediment to his, you know, integration into the wider reindeer society. And that was, so like I said, the intentionality gets a little bit difficult for some of them. But Charles Schulz actually, for the A Charlie Brown Christmas, was explicit in his use of the nativity scene from the Gospel of Luke. He said, if we don't do this, who will? So he really felt it was absolutely necessary to have that kind of sacred moment in there alongside the secular. So some of them we can kind of see the intentionality. Others, it's more of how is it being received than fully the intentions. It's sometimes hard to get at those intentions because people don't write things as to why they're doing it. They just give us that cultural product, mm-hmm. and we have to kind of figure out what does it mean. So,
well, you have investigated how the promotion of Christmas in these more secular, commercialized terms or contexts had impacts on Appalachian communities. What have you found there?
Well, what's really interesting, when I was starting some of this research, I came across a CBS report from 1965 with Charles Kuralt called Christmas in Appalachia. It was a half hour special or so, and I sat down and watched this. And the one thing that Kuralt kind of kept coming back to over and over again was this notion of Christmas as connected to consuming things, right? He at one point asks a laid off miner, you know, are the kids going to have a Christmas this year? Well, logically speaking, of course they will, right? They're Christian, you know, this Christian family, they will celebrate Christmas, but that's not what Kuralt is asking. He's asking, are they going to get presents this year? And that kind of connectivity of just being able to say, are they going to have a Christmas this year, with the implication, are they going to get presents by 1965 when this special comes out? Like, that's just understood. To be fair, I grew up in Western Pennsylvania, you know, and I heard those same things. You know, having a Christmas meant getting gifts. And so during this special, Kuralt asks this miner this. He hasn't worked in, I think it was 10 months. And he says, well, what I'm going to do is we're going to have, you know, we'll try to be happy that day, but I don't have anything to give them. And he's really kind of upset about that. And so kind of you can see in that report kind of this notion of Christmas and consumption is very much tied together.
Where are you with this research now? What are you still exploring?
Oh, I'm still kind of early in this. I'm looking at a number of different things. I want to keep digging in on Appalachia and questions about how poverty in particular in Appalachia and notions of Appalachia being somehow different and not quite American because of its poverty, how that affected, you know, its connection with Christmas and those types of things. I'm looking to expand a little bit more on the sights and sounds of Christmas in the Cold War. So moving beyond those Christmas specials to really pull in things like music and to think about advertising, both television and print media advertising, and thinking about who else gets left out of Christmas and what it means to be an American when those two things get tied together in this kind of consumer nature. So the poor or other communities that don't actually celebrate Christmas, can they now start to celebrate a more secular, nationalized Christmas and thereby maybe come closer into acceptance in the wider American community? So there's a lot of different ideas, a lot of things to kind of reach towards.
Okay. And very briefly, I know you have a book coming out in spring. What is the title of that book and what's it about?
Well, the book is Peace in the Mountains, Northern Appalachian Students Protest the Vietnam War. It's a adaptation of my doctoral dissertation, and it looks at students at Ohio University, University of Pittsburgh, and West Virginia University, and it tries to understand why they get engaged with various forms of activism, whether it's anti-poverty, civil rights, or anti-war activism. And the central point I keep coming back to in that one is that it's about citizenship, and that these young people have a definition of citizenship that is both that of a citizen of the university as well as citizen of the nation. And that in that vision of citizenship, it is very much engaged, and it's about the right to participate in the decision-making processes. So I looked at schools that, for the most part, people don't look at. They just assume are apathetic and try to find out what actually happened and why.
Okay, and that's coming out in the spring of 2020.
It is, yes, from the University of Tennessee Press.
Dr. Thomas Wyatt is an assistant professor of history at Black Hills State University in Spearfish, South Dakota. Thank you for joining us.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
And this interview was suggested to Eastern Standard by the Kentucky Historical Society. The Kentucky Historical Society is highlighting and supporting the works of researchers like Thomas Wyatt. You can visit history.ky.gov to learn more.
Got a feeling that Christmas Day is near, and the spirit of Santa Claus is here. Such a wonderful time when the snow is in town. It's a hell of a thrill when the sleigh bells sound. It's the time of the year for fleeting glances, when the guy in the store says, Merry Christmas. What a glorious night, singing old Tannenbaum. To be cozy and warm when the snow is falling down. It's a wonderful time, bet you more than a dime. The city bell's gonna chime, the Christmas star's gonna shine, and old folks singing in rhyme, Merry Christmas.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.fm or esweku.com, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.